Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Philip Terman. Philip Terman's books of poetry include The House of Sages, Book of the Unbroken Days, and Rabbis of the Air. His poems have appeared in many journals and anthologies, including Poetry, The Georgia Review, The Forward, The Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary Poetry, and Blood to Remember, American Poets on the Holocaust. Recipient of the Kenneth Patchen Award, the Sal's Ear Chapbook Prize, and the Anna Davidson Rosenberg Award for Poems on the Jewish Experience. He teaches creative writing and literature at Clarion University of Pennsylvania. Terman co-directs the Chautauqua Writers Festival and is contributing editor for poetry for the journal Chautauqua. He lives outside of Grove City, PA, with his wife Christine Hood and daughters Miriam and Bella. And he has a new book entitled The Torah Garden, which was published very recently by Autumn House Press. Hi, Phil. How are you?
Hi, Jan. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. You've been on Prosody before, but with this new book, we really want to hear these poems.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Okay. So you want to start with
Sure. Some poems? This is actually a poem. The first section is got some poems that are more urban centered. And this is when we lived in New York for a little while. And it's called Three Card Monte, which I wasn't very good at. I walked everywhere on that island, an island myself, 20, just up from the Midwest, ready to begin that long book called My Life, aimless, swayed by whatever was at hand, strolling, blind. On Fifth Avenue, a figure, emaciated, barely distinguishable in the skyscraper's shadow on the steaming sidewalk, inside of a circle of watchers. Above his podium cardboard box, he flashed three cards, two clubs and one heart, the queen. Then he turned them over in the quick slide, hands gliding like acrobats, the cards revolving around and over and under and through until they lost their shapes, spinning like blades, as if by some inner force, a fast-forward choreography. I couldn't keep my eyes off what I was sure to be the queen, the one to watch, certain if I held her attention, it would prove something I needed, what I had to master, this street preacher staring straight into my eyes and whispering, voice like gravel, a 20 will get you 100. And I was confident in the heart I tracked, staked my savings on what my eyes stalked. Of course, I was wrong, and I returned to the Midwest, where I had to start again from scratch, following in my mind the movement of those cards and the brilliant fingers that manipulated them until they became a blur, like that city I'm no longer certain was there at all. I'll read another poem. There's some poems about family, of course, and I'll read one of those. This is a poem inspired mostly by my Aunt Sylvia. It's called Two Geese. The two geese on the pond will not stop their kvetching, reminding me of my father and my Aunt Sylvia when one of them would throw down a gin rummy hand and the other would say, I can't play with you, and they'd both walk away, only to return back to their Pall Malls and their scotch and the only game that could save them. Sylvia was the gin rummy champion of the senior citizens division at the Cleveland Jewish Center, and she could belt out behind the ice cream counter, her cap barely balanced on her fierce red hair, a perfectly pitched aria. Last time I saw her, she was at the nursing home, dying of cancer, her voice like sandpaper shuffling against the trapped air. This is hell, she said, and I believed her. I have a few. There's a whole section in the book dedicated to my brother, who was killed in a car hit him when he was jogging, and so he was a world class scientist working at Albert Einstein Medical College and a cancer researcher. So I'll just read a couple sections from that. This is called Washing the Body. It refers to Jewish rituals of washing the body. I wanted to wash my brother's body the way he washed mine as children in the bath, squeaking and splashing, his older hand soaping my tender skin. I wanted to touch him one last time, not the way I brushed his chest when he lay exposed in his injury, his breath rising and falling to the rhythms of the machine, but rather to anoint with wet cloth his freckled face, around his blue eyes and small mouth, to work my way down the shoulders and chest and stomach, sponge his thighs and the hairs we both inherited from our father and from his father all the way back to our first hairy father, and so I am cleansing them too, if what we are is some portion of what others leave. And I wanted, while reciting he must depart as he came in, to clean his nails and brush his hair and to sprinkle holy soil onto his flesh and place broken pottery on his eyes, to wrap him in unbleached linen and place him in the pine container and recite the prayer of forgiveness for touching him so.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Philip Terman, and he's reading from his new book, The Torah Garden, published by Autumn House Press. One thing I love about your poems, Phil, is there's a huge sense of warmth and an authentic voice that comes through. And I wonder if you could talk about how important that is to you in your poetry, how you develop that warmth.
Well, thank you, Jan, for that. I do try for that. It's very important to me that whatever I write have an emotional connection, that I have an emotional connection with it. It has to hit me in what I call my poetry bone, on the gut level. You know, it has to really, really hit me. And I write until I can find, until it hits me. You know, so I have a lot of writing that doesn't hit me, but then eventually, you know, it moves. I try to move it towards that place, and that's where I know the poem is and wants to come out.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you were reading a poem, you said, and here are some poems about family, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, of course, is true for everybody. Can you talk about family as material for poems? And, you know, is it sometimes memory as minefield or memory as a fertile field for finding poems?
Both. But minefield is poetic, too. You know, I mean, it's... you know, so many contemporary poets. Yeah, you're right. Not everybody does write about family. I guess I was just referring to myself and many other poets. But it is the place to start. It's the place we start. Positive, negative, both. It's very complicated. You know, and you know, the Tolstoy thing about all families, all unhappy families are different. I believe all happy families are different too. To disagree with Tolstoy, but the whole notion of that's so much emotional resonance in that, and we're all trying to work that out. And you know, that's where you go first, and sometimes, you know, that's where you stay in a way, because there's so much there and there's so much fruitful minds in there,
right.
You know.
Right, and so many people are afraid to write about their families.
Yeah.
I mean, especially younger writers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to them for a minute about, you know, a lot of students will say, what if they read it? You know, how do
right.
I handle this difficult material?
Right, right. Yeah, I think that we can't be afraid of our emotions. I mean, I think that we get these gifts from the outside of ourselves that we need to write about, and we don't really have control over that. And, you know, the poetry, I think, is it transcends anything else. It's so important. It's at such a deep level. I wrote a poem for my father that he hated. It was about his car lot. He was a used car salesman. But then eventually he got published. Thank you. It got published, and he read it, and he hugged me for it. And then a week later, he died. And it was such an amazing story, such a longer story than that. But it's like we made this connection. But I you know, even though at first he thought I was making fun of his car lot, which in some part I was, but on a deeper level I wasn't. You know, he realized the deeper meanings there. And you have to write what you have to write. You have to follow your body, what it says.
Right.
It really does. And so that's the best advice I guess we can have.
Mm-hmm. Can you read some more poems?
Yeah. I'll read, I guess, one more poem from this brother section. This is very pretty cool, interesting, and crazy. My brother, the way he died, he was eligible for transplants. So his heart was one thing that was transplanted, and I know the person who's got his heart. And that's the last section of the poem of is my talk with her. It's called Speaking to the Woman with My Brother's Heart. Here you are again, brother, right in front of me, the most essential part of you, your heart, now carried by a 66-year-old grandmother, grateful for your death, I would say, but it would be wrong. She even apologized, though unnecessarily, that for her to live, you had to die. And I told her, you wouldn't die for anyone, but I'm not sure that's true. And what you taught us through your life, that a heart is a transferable thing, body to body, if we believe as you believed, in the mind's miracles, in the way, step by step, we discover that of which we are capable, to give life where there is no life, and to speak from the heart is to speak from the source of what is and isn't yours or ours. Will she allow me to place my hand on her chest so that I can feel your familiar pulsing? And further, will she consent to my request to rest my ear against her breast so that I can close my eyes and imagine the way I would hear your steady rhythm as we lay beside each other in that small room another life ago? And in that dark, will you live again?
That's a nice poem.
Thank you.
What's one interesting thing about that is that revising voice in the poem, you know, but I'm not sure that's true,
mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, and keeping that voice in the poem as a way to complicate, you know, this is not simple. Can you talk about that decision to keep that kind of voice in the poem?
Yeah, I think that that's so real, you know, the way we go back and forth. And I don't think I learned that, you know, I'm just learning that, you know. I think that's to realize how complicated we are and to make that complication poetry, to make poetry out of that complication,
mm-hmm.
I guess. You could do that. Sometimes it could be musical, you know. It has to be musical for me as well, you know, not just kind of, you know, everything that you ruminate about. But we're, you know, these are complicated. Sometimes it is complicated. And so, you know, putting that out there is important.
Yeah. And you read a lot of family poems that do seem more like reporting and haven't found the music, haven't found mm-hmm. the reason to be. So it's mm-hmm. so it's never a matter of just, mm-hmm. not just, but of telling that story. But you have to find what.
Do we really know what we, you know, I mean, we never really know for certain, but how could you bring that uncertainty and the emotion in at the same time?
Yeah,
you know,
that's
I think
true.
You can have the uncertainty without the emotion and the emotion without the uncertainty, but if you can have them both,
yeah.
that's cool.
That's right.
Okay, I'm going to read from the title poem, and it's 20 pages long, but I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's just I'm just going to read a few sections from it, and it brings together the garden that my wife, Christine, has and I help her with. I'm her slave, and it's called the Torah Garden. It brings together that and my interest in my Judaism. I sound the shofar for the new year, and in that suspended time, my life is focused in my mouth, lips on the ram's horn I purchased in Jerusalem, rending the air with its broken notes, summoning us to renounce. Fashion a kingdom, it says. Open yourselves up to the only moment there is, this stillness, this garden hanging on like the last blast of its bellowing breath. Late afternoon on a Saturday, designated the day of rest, and so this writing is a sin against the deep powers of silence. It's difficult to think of transgression on a day so full of early spring. Four ducks splash landed on the pond, and the daffodils are lifting their trumpets, announcing their bursting. No rest for the robins who gather their twigs and bits of grass, none for the lettuce seeds under grow lights, already thrusting their green spears through soil. Certainly no respite for the laborious pounding of my heart as I spy you dressing in a circle of sunlight, your flesh flushed by the love we've just made, according to some commandment. So will it come to pass? Will we receive rain in its season, the former rain and the later rain? Will the ground produce its fruit? Will we gather in the corn, the broccoli, the carrots, the peas, the beans, the squash, the tomatoes of every designation, the peppers, the laying down of seeds, laying them down like the words scribbled into the book of a life? And so Tolstoy was wrong. Families are not all happy in the same way. That the juice packed inside is also ours, that it will sweeten our tongues until our next language, the blueberries so abundant we grasp them by the handfuls, discreet and delicious and without damage, producing long after we unpin the netting and leave what remains for the birds that will plunder until they themselves are gone. Only the frost can stop them now, proliferating until summer itself perishes, according to the instructions of however long the light lasts. I eat the fruit of your seeds, Torahs in my mouth, dwelling in the devouring flame, in this garden where we allow wildness its portion, the bat with the injured wing crawling slow as a second hand up the spruce, stuttering one step at a time, pausing high above our heads and turning, facing us in its ascension. Keep yourselves holy, because I am holy. Okay, this is a little short section. After we're gone, you say, our shadows stretched against the tilled soil, we'll push up a tree together. And so I sound the shofar for the new year, and in that suspended time, my life is focused in my mouth, lips on the ram's horn I purchased in Jerusalem, rending the air with its broken notes, summoning us to thin ourselves out, to renounce. Fashion a kingdom, it says.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Philip Terman, reading from his new book, The Torah Garden, published by Autumn House Press. So, obviously you have an issue with Tolstoy.
I do. I love Tolstoy, but, you know.
You're like, he was wrong, and then he was wrong.
Exactly. You know, I like the fact that he was allowed me to speak to him and against him.
Okay. Can you talk a little about the interaction, if you see one, between the meditative and the narrative impulse in your work?
Yeah, I want to bring them right together. I want to interweave them. I want the meditative,
or the so narrative you call it the
to
narrative.
Be right, right. The narrative to be lyric, mm-hmm. and the lyric to be narrative, and merge them together. But you know, sometimes it leans towards one or the other, and that's fine too. I love narratives, poetry, stories, family stories, family poems lead to narratives, you know, and there are great stories out there. The Jewish tradition is full of stories. It's very narrative, and I come out of that, you know. But also I love James Wright's poetry, and I love the poetry of the present moment, and rural poetry and pastoral poetry, and you know, so I love just the lyric, and I see a place for just that without the background of the narrative. So, you know, sometimes one is on the front burner, one's on the back burner, but it's wonderful when they both work together.
Right. Yeah, I like that movement in your work. Like with some of the sections of the Torah Garden you were just reading, I was feeling the meditative a little more. Mm-hmm. But then I was thinking, no, there's a lot of details in here.
Yeah.
So I was, yeah, going back and forth. So.
Yeah, well, that was intentionally, you know, the lyric. I mean, it's about the garden, you know, and it's very short sections. And I wanted the lines to be really long. And, normally in my narrative poems, I have kind of like three-line stanzas or something like that. But in the Torah Garden, it's very disparate, kind of more Whitman-esque in that respect, mm-hmm. if I dare to bring up his name.
Oh, you've already disagreed with Tolstoy, so I think you can.
Yeah, let's do, okay? But Whitman's cool.
Okay. All right, can you read a couple more?
Sure, absolutely. All right. Like a bird entering through a window and leaving through another window. Well, I can tell you the tale of the woodpecker's persistence, the way we can tell time by its tapping throughout the morning, with or without us, the only scene in a certain angle of sunlight gossamer, spinning above that field, sparkling in dew drench and fog, signaling the season that no matter what, freezing rain or more unexpected snow, we have, despite all deceptions, this turning, this springing, as the willow with its beads from last night's rain agrees with whatever the swallows are suggesting. And I can tell you that today I'd really like to be happy, and that because we disappear, we want a singular life. What with the full day moon and deep lilacs, the afterworld to consider, not unlike the robin, unobserved, save for the singing, save for the shadows of its nest, save for the bits of hay it scatters on the wind, save for the wind, or the soil we become, which is something. And I can tell you that there's no telling what our deaths make us do, sermonizing the air, staring into the ripples, anticipating the frogs. It takes that much faith. It takes that much courage, wondering if love is a bird perched on the highest limbs of the soul. And I can tell you how every moment reveals our resurrection, and to wonder what or who allowed us to witness this fog disappearing, this water, these geese, this willow, is to wonder why the blue jay would look back to the branch from which it sprang into flight, and with so much sky ahead, or to speculate on how a tree's shadow is devoted to the tree until dark descends and they both disappear into a larger devotion, that place behind the ribs where we carry each person we love for the rest of our lives. And though we'll never be free of our grief, the fat rhododendron's purple is still drenched by the rain that woke us into love. How the world happens, by happenstance or design, that the candle burning all night and into the morning still burns doubled in the window. So let me tell you that we're nothing, unless you believe, as I do, that the soul travels from body to body, and so we must fill that soul with beauty and truth, and that as it came in, it goes forth, like a bird entering through a window and leaving through another window, and that our lives are an allowance for that soul to sing, sweetly, if it can.
Mm-hmm. Nice poem.
Thanks.
Can you talk a little bit about your influences? I mean, you've mentioned James Wright and Whitman, and but I felt like for a second in there, I mean, I could be wrong. I felt like I heard a little Ed O'Chester. You know that line when you said, "I can tell you today, I want to be happy." Hmm. I mean, it just really reminded me of some things Ed has written. I don't know if that touches anything for you or not.
Yeah, to some extent, I really love Ed's poetry, you know, and I think we both love very similar poets as well, like Wright and, you know, Whitman and, you know, poems of affirmation and joy, yeah. Yet also understanding the layers of grief that are part of that, mm-hmm. Not just a simple joy, but a joy that affirms even in the face of grief. And all the pains we have, yes, you know, that's that affirmation. So, yeah, sure.
Would you call yourself a poet of praise then?
Yeah, definitely. No doubt about it. A poet of celebration. Though there's a lot of, you know, I'm also very interested in history, particularly Jewish history in the sense of, you know, the Holocaust, for example, or, you know, there's a lot of death elegies. There's a lot of elegies in my poetry as well, mm-hmm. You know, ultimately I would say yes, mm-hmm. A poetry of praise, mm-hmm. No doubt.
Oh, great. Okay. We have time for some more poems.
Wow. Incredible. Okay. Well, maybe I'll do another poem that's not so much praise. In some ways it is, but it's the whole history thing. I lived in Oil City for a couple of years, and it's very close. We live near there now. And this in the book, there's a an elegy for Oil City, or it's called Oil City Serenade. It's in several sections. I'll just read a couple. But it's one of those cities that's part of the 99%, a city that is, you know, a town like many towns that are decimated by the economy, and oil was discovered nearby, so it was very wealthy for a while, but it's not anymore. Okay, I want to sing to you, Oil City, home of artist Butch Quinn, who is drinking a beer at midnight and drawing figures on canvas with cigarette ash, muralist of refrigerators dumped into the woods, the artist of logs left by the sawmill. You'll find him at the brass rail, ogling the single mothers back in college. Abused and abandoned, their exes steal their tires and hotwire their engines. Town of despair, let's paint you gray. Let's shimmy on down to the dollar store, where on the racks are the royal robes worn by every citizen. Let's sing the laid-off song, the downsize song, the song that says we're going south, sorry. Let's sing the welfare romp. Let's do Jake's Antiques, the old men behind the counter, sitting on torn leather chairs and smoking, staring out of the dusty window at the line forming in front of the Pennsylvania Lottery. One of them a few years back actually won big and has been in and out of jail ever since. Let's collect lottery tickets and beer caps and cigarette butts and smoke that floats through the air. Let's open an account of what we've lost, Quaker State, Continental Can, Pittsburgh Steel, all of the hospital but the mental health unit. Let's line up all the Prozac pills like coins along the petroleum bridge and offer our naked bodies to the telemarketing companies and Walmart. Once we were a city of Rockefellers. Once we bled our earth out of its sweet juices. Let's walk down to where the water cuts the town in half, shielded from the sharp beams of Route 8 that glow like searchlights now that dusk seeps beyond the hills, steep as walls pushed back against boarded-up buildings and dead-end streets. Smell grease in the air, chemicals floating like wounded birds from the one refinery left, and if that goes, we're done.
That's great. Thanks. We have time for a short one, I think.
All right. I'm going to do one more from the Oil City. I guess I might as well finish up with that. And here it is. It's just the second section of that poem. It's a little shorter. But have you lost yourself in a late morning fog for a good while as it breaks apart slowly above the hills? Have you smelled the matron of the Polish restaurant sweating, balancing dishes of pierogi steaming in the sauerkraut air? Have you heard the soiled smoke in Kirk Webb's voice as he slides his lumberyard fingers up and down the after-hour strings of his silver tone, demonstrating once again the resurrection of Robert Johnson? Has the corner of your eye caught in the twilight where the river forks, a bald eagle floating into the blurred edges? Have you heard Evelyn Green, small gray head under black beret, shuffling her 95 years, mumbling brilliant remarks about Zen Buddhism? Have you dreamed of the synagogue hovering over the town like a one-winged angel, like a floating Talmudic page?
The poetry of Philip Terman, reading from his new book, The Torah Garden. Thank you so much. That was great.
Well, thanks, Jan. It was so fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.